I got caught up in it because I thought I needed to be saved. And whilst I was still a good clinician and a good therapist for the people at the time, that was my blind spot. That was my blind spot. And I tell you something. It was the significant, most destructive, but incredible turning point in my life.
Welcome to the Social Fabric Podcast with me, Andrea Splendori. And this week, I'll be playing you a podcast that I recorded live with Louise Carroll in the Whale Theatre in Greystones, County Wicklow. Louise is a psychologist, is a musician, a composer, a bass player with the Blizzards, and founder of Prism Online Therapy. It's a wonderful conversation. It starts with a composition by Louise used in a series called Assassins. Please subscribe, share, and review. Is much appreciated. The show is also broadcast weekly on Near FM 90.3 and Flirt FM 100.3. The title tune is Alice by Lucky Bones.
Can I call you up, oh Alice, on a Friday night? We could reminisce on old days and we could talk a while. Sit and talk a while. Been so long now since I've seen you. It's been 10 years.
Hello, good evening. And thanks a million for coming tonight. We were just having a laugh with Louise this, because this, as I said, this was Louise's composition, but she didn't know I put a Betty Boop video on it, so she hadn't seen it. So thanks a million for coming. Delighted to see you all. Hello. And thanks a million for the staff here, as always, a fantastic staff here at the Whale Theatre. Joe, Noemi, Neil, Brian, Pete, and everybody else I can remember. So listen, thanks a million. If all going well, if on the 22nd they give us freedom to start again, to do proper gigs, we have a series of up close and personal coming up for you. But tonight my guest is Louise Carroll, and who is Louise? Louise is quite an amazing human being. She's a psychologist. She's a composer. She writes peer-reviewed paper, and she writes for the Sunday Business Post, and she's a regular contributor on Today FM. She's a bass player for the the blizzards and so on and so forth. There's loads of stuff we can talk to her about. So that was her composition. That's her. So if you could please give Louise a big round of applause and come and join me on stage, Louise. And she never told me she was going to dress up for the night, so welcome on stage, Elise. We're very, I think your microphone is just behind you. I think you're sitting on it.
Wrong thing amplified.
So, so this is Louise Carroll. Thanks, Amelia, for joining. We were just chatting upstairs because we have a green room. When you're an artist, you have a green room, and it's fantastic. We were just chatting about a few different things. And I just said I want to start with Navan. Louise, you're from Navan. I just put a couple of pictures because a lot of the people in the audience are from Greystones. They don't really go beyond, you know, Bray. So this is Navan. Louise, what was it like growing up in Navan?
God, I don't remember any of this at all, but this looks beautiful. Navan, what Navan is now, I think, is incredibly different to what it was when I was growing up. I feel like it was a small community. And I feel like everybody knew everybody's business. So, you know, that's only, I was going to say 20 years ago, but actually 30 years ago, more. It was tight-knit, actually. And, you know, when you ask that question, my first instinct is like, oh, Navan, God, no, I'd never go back. But and that's partly true. But that said, I actually had, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed growing up. We were really close. I had a good network of friends. There were central points in the town. That's where you went to. Everybody knew you. Everybody knew each other. That was good and bad. But I actually enjoyed growing up in Navan. I grew out of it pretty quickly, though.
Well, we were talking upstairs. I was saying to Louise, when I met school in Rome, I used to go to the Colosseum. And she she was, it was a little bit different in Navan. What were you doing when you were in middle school?
I just never heard anything so bougie as that. You meet school, we used to go behind the railway tracks. Like, it was like down the Colosseum. I have to buy tickets for. No, we. I didn't. I was actually pretty well behaved. My sister was the rebel in the family, so when it came to me, I had learned all the tricks, so I behaved. And if I didn't, nobody knew about it. She made all the stakes quite publicly and got in trouble, but I found ways to get around it. But we didn't. I actually was pretty diligent. I was a bit of a nerd in school. It was, I feel, and I still maintain that I actually didn't hit teenage rebellion till my 30s.
And why do you think it's that, you being the psychologist?
Because I learned how to be good. I thought from an early age, I figured out how I could be relevant, and that was I could help. So I could help my mates who were pissed down the railway tracks, you know, or I could help people who were going through a rough time, or I could help people in my family. And it gave me a purpose from pretty early on. And I suppose I did have an instinct for it, what helped people. I'm pretty empathic, so I would feel that. You know, my mom is very emotional as a person. She's wonderful, extremely emotional, very deep. And we would always have conversations that were pretty deep. So it set me up to connect to people that way. But it also put me in the position of helper.
And did that hinder your childhood, do you think, being the helper?
Hinder would be a strong word. I think if we were talking in relationship to the previous point, which is my rebellion didn't happen until age 30, then yes. But I do think it opened up a world of understanding human beings. And I was fascinated with humans. Fascinated. I still am. You know, I always remember hearing first when there was a murder. And I think it was, you know, back then there weren't that many murders in Ireland. Actually, I think it was Sophie Toscan de Plante. And I remember thinking, no, maybe it wasn't her. It could have been someone else before that. But I just remember thinking, what makes people kill? what makes people go to those lengths? Is it passion? Is it anger? What's missing? What happened? And I remember that from a really early age, thinking, what happened? What happened to them? What happened to them that's where they ended up? And so forensics was actually what I wanted to do initially. And then I had a little dalliance with Dundrum Mental Hospital, and I kind of pictured a life in that sphere, and I decided maybe I should do something a bit lighter
than forensic, than
the criminally insane. Yeah.
Okay, we'll get to that bit of the psychology in a minute. But you mentioned your mum there in terms of somebody that you kind of looked up to and figure. Tell me a little bit more. Just good.
Well, my parents. I always talk about them like this. They're hippies, but they're wild at the same time. They're, you know, I lived in six different houses by the time I was 17. They're creative. They're adventurous. They're deep thinkers and they're passionate. And they had and have a turbulent relationship. And you know, that was probably part of my fascination with humans too, was, you know, and that's where I learned a lot about relationships, obviously, as we all do from our parents watching them as we grow up. Mm-hmm. And they set a template. You know, my mom was the deep kind of passionate thinker. My dad was a very practical, strong, still is, man. And I really look up to him. But it's funny because it was almost, and I don't mean to use the word allegiance, but I'll use it to be blunt. I feel like it kind of went from my mom, who was, you know, the soft kind of emotional when I was growing up as, you know, the young girl, to my dad, who taught me how to be strong and taught me how to fight for myself. And, you know, if I'm the only girl in the room, what are you going to do about that? How are you going to handle that? You know, what are you going to do to be seen? How are you going to make sure that your voice is heard? And he pushed me. He really pushed me. You know, he pushed me to the limit at times. But in hindsight, as I look back, I think he saved me from that pool of beautiful, wonderful emotion from my mum. But that would have sank me out in the real world.
Yeah, we were just saying to Louise upstairs, I said, look, I put a video on your song. Sorry, I didn't ask you for it, but I purposely picked that song, that video, because it's Betty Boop is the only girl in the whole video, and they're all waiting for her to arrive, and she's just done her hair and whatever she was doing. But that's what you've encountered a lot, even in your creativity and your music, yeah. In the business of music, yeah. Which is what I want to ask you. So I didn't know until last week. I met Louise a couple of times, but I didn't know she also composed music. I thought she was just a bass player, which we'll get to that as well. But composing music, when did you start to compose music? You did that music we listened to, that was for a movie called Rabbit Run?
Rabbit Punch, that was actually Assassins, that one.
Sorry, different. That was Assassin, there you go.
But I had a kind of an up and down journey with music. I loved music always, you know, and I had that age-old relationship with it when I was growing up, where I wanted to be a musician. That's all I wanted to do from I was six. But, you know, my parents were like, go to college, get a degree, do the steady thing, get a job, and then you can do music. And it was always that push-pull thing. And, you know, always with my family, it was, are you still doing the music? like they actually still do that. I'm like, yeah. I'm in the blizzards. and even still now at this point, my dad is, if he sees something on TV, he'll go, oh, okay, ish, still okay. But how's psychology? You know, how's the work going? How are the clients going? You know, but it's an age old thing, you know, and I don't resent it anymore. I used to push furiously back against that, you know, because I just thought music is as legitimate a career as anything else. It's much tougher, I will say, than anything else. But so I worked as a singer-songwriter, and I wrote songs, and I was pulling together an album. That's what I did long before composing. And I think this is probably where my dad's voice came into it, where I really started to understand what he was trying to teach me as I was growing up, because I was quite naive in many ways, but I'd also learned to silence myself. And if people helped me out, I was so grateful, you know, because, well, they were doing me a favor. All of the time I perceived people were just doing me a favor, as opposed to, no, I deserve to be here. No, actually, I worked hard. No, actually, I have a gift. No, actually, this was what I wanted and I made it happen. No, no, it was always, oh, thank you. Thanks for letting me be here. You know, thanks for giving me a space on the stage. And for that reason, I was always on the back foot. I also had trouble, therefore, setting boundaries. So I met, you know, pretty difficult people in the industry. And that was my first official formal foray into music. And it didn't go so well at all. It was actually pretty, it was really, really difficult. And it was, if I'm to pick out, I have about three different points over my lifetime where they were quite life changing. That was one of them. Crossroads, if you will. And I dropped everything. It just, I met some difficult people. They were pretty cruel. I was naive and I took it really to heart. And it just, I stopped. I stopped singing. I didn't pick up a guitar for a year and I didn't know what I was. I didn't know who I was. If I wasn't this, if I wasn't going to do what my passion was, what am I here for? And I was lost. I was truly, truly, truly lost. But I'm smiling because every time I've been lost in my life has been the most memorable time that I've actually been saved at the same time, because it has always propelled me to take steps in a direction in my own honor. And I talk about this a lot. What are you doing in your own honor? You know, how are you advocating for yourself? And it was that time actually that I quit everything. I quit everything. I left everything. I left the relationship I was in. I left the house I lived in. I quit my job and I went to Costa Rica and I managed a horse ranch for 6 months and I rode across the country on a horse. And I literally just needed to feel alive. I needed to feel like I was in control of something, even as crazy as that sounds. I needed to feel like I owned my life, not these people, you know, who told me I was shit and I was never going to make it. Not those people. I was not going to let them rule. And that was kind of part of my finding myself. And when I came back, that's when I thought, okay, well, maybe I'm not going to be the singer, but I think music still needs to feature. And that's when I just started thinking about film music. And I remembered Requiem for a Dream, which I don't know if you know that film, but it's quite twisted. But the theme song is called Lux Aeterna and it's by Clint Mansell. And I mean, I think I've seen a film when I shouldn't have seen that film. I was about 9 or 10 or something. And that theme always, always, always stayed with me. And it gets used a lot, gets used for ads. But it came back to me just one day and I just thought, God, people write film music. And it just sounds a bit weird to think of it like that. But it was people write film music. That's pretty incredible. And then I didn't look back. I went straight for it and I trained in Bulgaria and then I went to LA and I worked with I figured out how to get to Clint. This is actually a bit embarrassing, but I figured out very intensely how to get to Clint Mansell through London, and I eventually did. And now we're friends. So he gave me a leg up in a few different ways and helped me get a little bit of work in LA and that kind of thing. So yeah.
But I have a fair idea you write a song. Not that I can write a song, but I have a fair idea the melody, the lyrics, and stick them together, you know, a couple of chords.
Mm-hmm.
But I was looking at your website. It's easy, right? So it's easy that you can hear somebody it's laughing. Very easy.
Yeah.
You know, it's really easy songs out there. Three chords in the truth, one of the band said, whatever. But I was looking at your website, and there's this couple of photographs of your score. And it says, you know, piano and B flat and cymbals. And I was like,
in that order, yeah.
Or whatever. But how'd you do that? How'd you compose? You obviously don't play every instrument, but in your head, is that what happens? In your head, you get all these things.
Oh, I'll never forget when that was another thing. I'm like, right, I'm going to be a composer. That's what I'm going to do. Got on the flight, went over to Bulgaria. And I remember the very first day sitting in that course at the back of the room, and he's a fairly well-known conductor stood up at the top of the room, and the room was full of I mean maestros, or virtuosos, like piano players, violin players from Poland, China, like, I mean proper players. I didn't really mention that I was calling myself a half-baked musician, because I don't really read music. It's all by ear. Everything I've done is by ear, always. So I'm sitting in a room kind of, and they're talking about, well, now by the end of this course, you're going to be arranging and orchestrating for a 36-piece orchestra. And you're going to be recording the pieces that you write while you're here. It's like, oh God, I really didn't read the prospectus. I was like, oh, fucking hell. And as he kept talking, I must have kept getting paler and paler and paler, because he came down to me. He's like, are you okay? I was like, mm-hmm, yeah. And he was like, okay, let's meet after the class. So afterwards, I honestly walked out of that room and I was like, I have to book a flight home. This is the most stupid thing I've ever done. And we sat down and... He wasn't great either. He's like, so you write music, obviously. And I was like, and by write, what do you mean? And he was like, well, you can use Sibelius, like, to do the, you know, to plot the music. And I was like, what's Sibelius? and he actually put his head in his hands and he went, okay, well, I don't want to see a crash and burn. And then he sat back in the chair and lit a cigarette. I was thinking, oh Jesus Christ. And I went back to my room and I thought, okay, I'm just gonna have to go for this somehow. Like, I'm one thing that I have is that I'm brave. I'm brave. So I went, right, I'm just gonna do it. And as it turned out, one of our lecturers was Christopher Young, who he does all the scores for horror movies. He did Nightmare on Elm Street and, well, he actually did Spider-Man as well. And anyway, he's really eccentric, and he came in with an American flag around his shoulders and a hat and feathers sticking out of it. And he was brilliant. But over the course of his week of teaching, he would do little competitions and, you know, it would be like, who could write the best motif to cover some of his, you know, his films. He's like, right, this is what I did in this section. Now you go away and do something and I'll pick the best one. We'll see who wins. And every time I won.
Wow.
Because I'm a songwriter. So I would write the hook. So I would write the thing that everybody could sing back. And, you know, you'd have virtuosos writing these most eccentric, complex counterpoint pieces on the piano, and people would have to sing it back, and obviously nobody could, because it was just so complex. Lots of B flats in it, for example. So, but everybody could sing back the hook because it would just be simple. You know, it would be songwriter. So it would just write something simple. And that's what we remember from films. It's the little simple hook. It's the motif. Look, I was watching Halloween last night, you know, and it's two notes. Jaws is two notes. You know, when you think about it, it's, so basically, I took the easy way out and did film composing because I'm a shit musician. That's what I'm trying to say.
Well, it worked. I spent most of the afternoon listening to your stuff, and it's really good. And I say to you, I don't do compliments very easily, but it was good. But the other thing that it was interesting is I listened to some of your songs, and we will get to psychology in a minute. There's a method to this madness. There's the songs that you have on your website and some of the ones you sent me. As I was saying to you, it's a beautiful sounds, but I was listening to it for the sounds, and then the next thing was the lyrics, and I was like, whoa, these are very raw, very visual. Like, as I said, you can hear, you can see what's going on in the song. There was one particular one called Black 29, which I had to listen twice. I was like, okay, I need to ask Louise, what's this all about? Can you tell me what it's all about? And you can go and listen to it. You don't have to, but it's really striking lyrics.
Yeah, yeah. I was 29 when I wrote it, and it was a black time. So I was in a relationship at the time, and that song is about the experience of feeling inherently unseen, despite efforts, despite what you do, despite trying so hard and wearing yourself out and wearing yourself thin till you barely exist for yourself anymore. but they still don't see you. And, you know, that's almost 10 years ago now. And I remember the process of writing that song. It was probably the most painful, actually, because I think it was probably the most accurate expression of words for an experience that I've had. That song is, I find it hard to listen to that song.
So did I.
Yeah.
And right. I didn't know anything about it. But yeah. It is fantastic. It is genuinely amazing. Like, that's the bit about the black dress dropping. And it's just you could see it without knowing anything behind. You can see the story. And it's fantastic in one way. But obviously, now you're telling the background. And it's, I can.
Thank you.
You can hear.
Yeah. I'm quite an expressive person, but not in a very obvious way, not in a public way. Not in a...
Well, I would like to correct you on that.
Oh, shit.
So, this is Luis. Luis is also the bass player for the Blizzards. And I like this. I love this photograph. Look at the fingernails on Luis playing the bass. I don't know how you do that, but...
I grew them myself.
But you weren't always the bass player for the Blizzards, right? You're relatively recent to the band. How'd you get in?
So.
Look, it is cool up close in person. I'm going to have to ask you a few questions.
No, okay, it's okay, it's okay. It's okay. I take responsibility for my actions. So I had met Niall, I think about 2 years prior to that. And we'd met on and off, obviously on the music scene, but also through mental health. But some of the things that the Blizzards were working on needed some backing vocals. So I had actually provided some backing vocals in studio, on a couple of occasions. And then I actually did a gig with them in Malahide Castle, I think. Just two songs and sang with them then. And that was it. And that was June 2017, I think. And I think that was all. I might have done one other thing with them before the end of that year. And so then I think it was New Year's Day, Niall messaged and said, "Do you play the bass?"
The answer was yes.
And I said, yes. But I didn't. And... He was like, "Oh, great." He's like, "Because, you know, the bass player we have, he's probably going to be leaving, you know, family dependencies and that kind of thing. It's like his circumstances are changing. So that's great. So, like, would you be up for playing in the band?" I'm like, "Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, of course. Yeah, no problem. Like, no problem." And then put the phone down and just thought, fuck. But at the same time, thought, I've always wanted to be in a proper proper band. And so he was like, "All right, cool." So I said, "So now, the only thing is, I just don't have my bass at the moment, so..."
Because I never played it.
It's just, yeah. I just moved house so many times, and it's in one of the other ones. And so I'm just going to need, like... So a little bit of time just to find it. And he was like, "Oh, no, we can lend you one. Like, we have one." I was like, "Oh, great. Great." Oh, that's good. So then I think a month went by, like, you know, they were getting themselves sorted or whatever. And I just said, "Okay, cool. There's just a lot going on for me for the next 2 months." So is, you know, April okay that we would meet up and maybe do a first rehearsal? And he was like, yeah, it'll probably take that long for us to actually kind of get moving again anyway. So I was like, great. So I actually spent, and I shit you not, like about 5 to 6 hours a day learning how to play the bass. Because I was just determined to be, I've always wanted to be in a rock band. I perceive them as a rock band. I won't hear any different. So I always wanted to be, and I was just going to make it happen, essentially. Brilliant. I used to sleep with the bass. Like, I would wake up and it would be lying beside me on the pillow. It's a really sad story. But anyway, it worked.
It worked. Yeah. Fantastic. It's amazing. Fair play to you.
Thank you.
And just, you guys just re-released the, Trust Me, I'm a Doctor there last week for Heroes Age, and I'm actually going to play the video in a second, but what was that all about? What was the Hero's Age? Why did you pick that? And I know you re-recorded with is the RTE Orchestra?
Yeah, the RTE Concert Orchestra. Yeah. Well, I mean, trust me, I'm a doctor is the obvious choice, but you know, we just really felt it. I mean, for us as well in the music industry, like 18 months of just, you know, our careers got shot in the head by a bat in Wuhan, you know, essentially, and everything was drawn to a halt. And then all of us were sort of exposed to it in different ways for different reasons. You know, my parents were and are in Spain, so I didn't see them for 2 years, you know, and that was really difficult. It was really tough. But what we all kind of had a tangible experience of throughout was that frontline workers just had to keep going, you know. And like, I remember, you know, we forget these things, and we forget it because it's protective to forget just how horrible it was, just how horrible it felt to think, if I go over there and say hello to that person, I could kill them. If, like, literally, those were the thoughts we were having. I could kill them, and that might be my fault. Mm. Like, that was traumatic. But these people were day in, day out at that front line, doing their work, doing their job, and had to get through it, you know. And obviously we spoke to some of them, and you can hear them at the start of our video, and like that, they had to get through it. And it's only as they talk about it now that the emotion is even coming up, because now they've time to think, now they've time to breathe. And obviously, you know, we're very sensitive to mental health in our band as a collective. So, you know, we thought, well, they're going to need support, you know. And it is only after, and I know we're not out of it yet, but it is only after the event that you really start to process these things. So we thought, well, why not raise money and support Heroes Aid, who help them to access therapy? So that's the whole idea, that we would raise money so that they can get therapy and they need it.
Fantastic. And we're just going to play the video for 3 minutes so Louise can have a drink of her Guinness and play it away, Neil. And it's a great song, and I think it was 10 years ago, so when it was first released. This is the new version with the orchestra. Mm-hmm. But it's providing therapy to frontline worker. That's what Hero Says do.
That's exactly it. Okay. Yeah.
That's it. And where's Neil gone? Anyway, there he is. Go for it. And there you go. We'll be quiet. I hope you can all see it. Get out of your way.
My advances calls for a plan of radical action. We are trust me, I'm a doctor. Trust me, I'm a doctor. Take me back to your place. Take me back to your place. Don't say no, 'cause now there is no reason. Don't say no, 'cause now there is no reason. Trust me, trust me.
Great video, well done. Yeah, it's quite striking actually when you look at the video. I was just thinking that, what was I complaining about at the time? I think because I couldn't go to Killarney or something, or I couldn't go on a holiday or something. Then you look at that video, it's very striking, well done. Which brings me nicely into charities and mental health. You know, we still have to do some charity work for a mental health system, which I know you believe as well that it's quite broken. And but you were one of the founding members of Headstrong, that then became Jigsaw, am I correct?
Yeah, so Headstrong began in a tiny little office in, well, it's Jigsaw, you probably all know it as now, but it's began in a little office in UCD with Dr. Tony Bates, who you might know, myself, Bob Ilbach, who's from the States, and Barbara Dooley, who's a researcher. And there was a vague idea that we wanted to do something for youth mental health, because what happened was, there was a big lecture, 700 people attended, showed up. We thought maybe 100 people would show up. 700 people showed up. The Theatre L in UCD was overflowing, and it was to talk about youth mental health. And we never expected that we'd be seven times the amount of people. We couldn't let people in. There was an overflow theatre and a projector. And so this was back in 2007. And it really wasn't being talked about at the time. Suicide rates were worryingly high. And there was nowhere for them to go. And, you know, what prompted this in terms of services was that we had, you know, we had a child and adolescent services, the service that stopped at 16. And we had an adult service that began at 18. So what happened in between? You know, so we had all these young people falling between the cracks. And if they didn't fall between the cracks, if they were taken into adult psychiatric care, then you just had, you know, a 16, 17, 18-year-old in an adult psychiatric ward looking at people who are profoundly ill, thinking, that's me now. And really painting a trajectory that was pretty grim for them. So those were our early stories, and that was a chaotic but really important day. And it was actually the night of Sweden versus England, and that's why we thought nobody would show up in the World Cup, I think. Yeah. So we were so shocked with what happened, and that's what actually prompted the birth of Headstrong, which is now Jigsaw.
While I was kind of researching a bit of what, you know, what you normally talk about in terms of in the public arena, in terms of my mental health and psychology, I was listening to some Brezzi's Where's My Mind podcast, where you and Tony Bates are the psychologists in residence, if you want, you know, discussing different things that the audience want to talk about. It was striking to hear that the first thing that we were talking about, narcissism, and that was overwhelmingly the most talked about thing. Now, before I ask you about narcissism, do you think that a lot of the responses were informed by the fact that it was coming from an audience online, an audience on social media? And what is narcissism, and why are we so worried about it at the moment?
Well, the first question, do I think it was informed because it was coming from people in social media? I have to say, I've never had as many direct messages into my Instagram as I had after that particular podcast. Mostly from women, not always. There were some men in there, but mostly from women who had been in relationships with narcissistic abuse, some of whom were still in it and didn't know how to get out. But for the first time, I had heard something that resonated, that they could understand, and that they felt understood and heard. Some who had gone through it and who'd come out the other side, and who were very moved by the conversation as well, because it was the first time they'd heard it discussed so openly on a platform here. I think what we're talking about in terms of social media and what we see narcissism in social media is different. You know, narcissism, we all need to have some level of it to some degree. Otherwise we will never stand up for ourselves. You know, we have to know what we're worth. When we're talking about narcissistic abuse, we've moved into a completely different field and it's quite dark in there. You know, and we're dealing with people who have an inflated sense of themselves. And usually it's to cope with a dearth of love or being seen or having recognition or acknowledgement as a child. There's a reason for it. It doesn't come out of nowhere. It's not bred into the, you know, it's not knitted in when somebody's born. It's really not. It's what you're exposed to. And if you don't have that, if you're not seen as a child, you know, if you're not mirrored, if nobody attunes with you in terms of what you feel, then you create your own world to give yourself a sense of worth. And depending on just how absent it was as a child, usually relates to just how big your attempt to protect this fragile ego is as an adult. And with that, your encounters with other people becomes, how can I get fuel from other people to feed this sense of self? How can I, it becomes about, I see you now. What can you do for me? How can you inflate my sense of self? How can you make me feel better about myself? And at the moment that you start to see me differently, because usually I love bomb you, usually I'll completely win you over the start because I've learned how to charm. That's what I do as a narcissist. I'm speaking from the narcissist point of view. I've learned how to charm. I know what to do because I've honed my skills to do that. Such is the need to protect my sense of self. So I will charm you. And then when you start to see through me, and I know that you start to see through me, then I start to devalue you, and then I discard you, and then I move on. So every encounter with a human being in a relational context is void of depth. It's void of true intimacy. They don't feel what you feel. They see you in terms of what you can do for them, how you can fill them up. And as soon as you stop doing that, you're gone. That's narcissistic abuse.
Let's say the moment you start to talk about this subject, everything has changed in you, and it's fabulous. But I was listening, and you mentioned narcissistic parents. It was a new concept to me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand it.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me
more. Good. You're lucky that you don't. It's you know, narcissism is on the spectrum of being a sociopath, a psychopath.
Okay.
It's on the same spectrum. Now, you can have a narcissist who's not a sociopath. Okay. You can't have a sociopath who's not a narcissist. You can have a narcissist who's not malignant. It generally goes narcissist, malignant narcissist, sociopath.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, we see a lot of narcissists in the public sphere. They're not necessarily malignant narcissists, which is really quite dangerous and can destroy you from the inside out.
I meant to say we'll leave a few minutes at the end for anybody who wants to ask Louise a few questions, so don't expect me to ask all the right questions. But the parenting thing in the therapy room, you know, you do a lot of work in therapy with a lot of people, and this is it's more for me really than anybody else. I'm really curious about this because as a parent,
mm-hmm.
Like I'm really good at my job apart from this bit here. I'm really good. Shit
Pretty
off.
Pretty good at this.
I'm excellent. But when it comes to parenting, I'm going, my daughter is here, my son is not here, but I'm going, am I really that good? And it's the hardest job I've ever done. Mm. And I never get it right. Is the parenting, I guess I'm looking for an answer to be a parent. No, but is parenting, you mentioned narcissistic parents, but what comes into your therapy room, and I know your confidentiality and the rest of it, what else comes in at the moment in terms of parenting and worries about I don't know. Is it anxiety? Is it depression? What is it? What is out there?
Parents are terrified. Terrified. Of doing something wrong. That they're doing something wrong. That they're causing depression in their child. That they're causing anxiety in their child. That they're doing the wrong thing. That they're doing too much. That they're doing too little. You know, we're also exposed to so much information now. That what do you pick? Which is it? What do? You know, you've got bullet lists of how to behave. You've bullet lists of how to have a conversation, how to communicate, how to feel. So much so that we have lost contact with how we actually feel. And we don't know how to get there. We don't know how to reconnect. Because we're so overwhelmed with other people telling us what to do and how we should be. And then we pass that on, you know, to our relationships or to, as a parent, to our children, not intentionally, but we're so lost in trying to grip and grab hold of some element of truth to do a good job that we miss that the good job is just being present and listening. What's going on for you right now? I don't have the answer. I don't have the answer as a parent. I don't have the answer, but tell me. What is it like for you now? Because I was never 16 in 2021. You tell me what it's like. You know, and I think, especially in the therapy room, that's a lot of the process, is you are not supposed to have all the answers for your children. You're not supposed to, but you are supposed to walk with them when they're finding their own answers. Your job as a parent is to have your hand on their back when they go out to find their own answers. That's what it is. And, you know, Winnicott said, he was one of the early attachment theorists, said, this is about good enough parenting. How can you be good enough? That's it. That's it.
So you said a wonderful thing that the other day in one of the interviews, is as a person arriving at the therapy room, it's an achievement in itself and they should be applauded for it. Not sure if it was verbatim, that it's important to get, like, my understanding of therapy was this for a long time, you know, was the man from afterlife and, you know, and lying down and going out. But now that I never been to therapy and I never had to go to therapy, but, and we'll get to Prism in a second, your new enterprise and that you're launching at the moment, but we were talking about earlier on, you know, there's a spectrum, you know, if I'm having a shitty day, it's a shitty day. If I'm having a shitty week, it's a shit. Is it mental health? You know, where is this? It's a big pendulum between going to see Louise for a session because I'm having a shitty day or a shitty week. I'm just confused about too much talk about mental health or too little talk. And I know there's a bit of a spectrum there. And I know there's this pendulum swinging. It's just confusing me.
The word spectrum is important because mental health is on a spectrum.
Okay.
It's not that you either have it or you don't.
Okay.
We're always moving up and down. It's so fluid, you know, depending on what we're exposed to on any given day, it moves. And that's okay. It's supposed to. It lets us know something's going on. It lets us know something's off track. It lets us know that we need to write something. Or we ignore that. And so it slips and it has a steady slip. Because we keep pushing it down, what it is that we need to learn. And that's when it becomes tricky. You know, but it is, this is the way it always is. You know, the absence of mental illness is not mental health either. So it's not one or the other. And, you know, I think back in the day, you know, you needed to have snapped and what it was called a nervous breakdown in Ireland. Oh, she had a nervous breakdown, you know, but that covered everything. Everything. That was what it was. Oh, she's disappeared. She's a nervous breakdown. Oh, she won't get out of bed. She's a nervous breakdown. You know, but yeah, I'm quite vehement in how we speak about mental health and what people experience, you know, and there is same as what I just said about parenting or about looking online. You have reams and reams and reams of blog articles, of newspaper articles, and I'm contributing to it, you know, of Instagram posts, of LinkedIn posts, of books, of how to, of simple bullet lists again about how to have better mental health or well-being or programs or whatever it might be. And you know, I went away 2 weeks ago and I listened to an audiobook by John O'Donohue. And it was the most refreshing thing I'd listened to in a while because he spoke, and I'm a psychologist And I believe in the value of analysis. I believe in the value of speaking, of talking, of sharing what you're going through. But what he spoke about was the value of shutting up, the value of actually going inward, the value of actually taking the time to stop projecting, to stop mining every single thing with words, to stop labeling every single thing you go through, to stop externalizing everything that you feel as soon as you feel it, or taking a picture as soon as you're in it. We're ruining it. We're destroying the experience of life just by doing that. And he talked about the beauty in existence is going inward so much, or it's connecting to nature, you know. And it's, Paulo Neruda said, he said, I lived amongst the weeds and I liked it more than the flowers, you know. And I resonate with that. And I know I'm on the stage and all that, and that probably doesn't sound like it's true, but it is. You know, I do feel like anytime I reconnect with myself, it's when it's away from the public eye. It's when it's away from having to put posts up online, and it sucks the life out of me. I'll be honest, it sucks the life out of me, because it's a constant creation of an image. And what is an image that's curated? Nothing. It's brittle. It's vacuous. And I'm not that. And it detracts from me every time I do it. But the rediscovery of yourself by pulling back from that is almost like a kind of rediscovery of who you are again. And that time away allowed me to see that. And I really would, if you're interested in that kind of thing, John O'Donohue is incredible. And he speaks about that. And he speaks about the prison of analysis, actually. And I know this sounds contrary to what we've just spoken about, but the prison of analysis, keeping you locked inside a narrative of what defines you, you know. And again, big purporter of working through your trauma, but does your trauma now define you? Because if it is, that's what's keeping you in prison. You're keeping yourself in prison. The trauma happened 10, 20 years ago. What are you doing? What are you doing? Let go. Because you're keeping yourself stuck behind those bars, you know. And it's a difficult conversation to have, because it's nobody's fault that they went through that trauma, you know, if they're the victim of it. Mm-hmm. But now it's in your hands. What are you going to do next? And sometimes it's going inward. Sometimes it's connecting inward that will allow you to move forward and out of it. And sometimes we can go too far into the reading the lists of what to do and how to live, that keeps us even more stuck. It's a fine line.
You're extremely passionate about your work. It's obvious, you know. I've never been to your therapy room, but I'm sure you're, I don't know, are they called clients, patients? I'm not sure what you call them.
Clients, yeah.
Clients.
Yeah.
But the clients come to you with some heavy-duty trauma issues, and you're obviously very empathic. You said at the beginning, you know, you started off very young to having to look after everybody, feeling that you needed to look after people. So you've been absorbing a lot of other people's trauma for the last 22 years, whatever you've been around. And what do you do to get that trauma out of your system, apart from listening to John O'Donohue who had gone on holiday? What do you do on a daily basis to just wash it off? Because you have to wash it off, right?
I do. And it's funny you ask, because I am in a bit of a transition about having to pay more attention to that, actually. You know, and again, we get so swept up, and I say we because I'm trying not to take responsibility in this moment in time. But generally, we tend to get swept up in the work that we do and what we're doing in our endeavors, you know, and everything that we've, I think, been through as well, you know, in the last 18 months. I personally threw myself into work. That's how I coped. I threw myself into, what can I create? What can I do? How can I shift my career into something that makes sense? And I've done that, but I've also hit a point where I realize I don't always remember how to let go. I don't always remember how to have fun, actually. You know, just ridiculous, let loose fun, which I was always typically quite good at. But it is something I need to rediscover, quite honestly. You know, and back when I, around the time that I did the Costa Rica thing, I also took up MMA. And so I trained in MMA for 2 years, and that was an incredible, with men up in the inner city in Ossory Road, like in a warehouse. It was so bizarre, but I loved it. You know, I did. I loved it. I wouldn't do it again. I got really injured a lot, but it served a purpose at the time. And I'm at that point now where I need to find something else. It's not going to be that, but it'll be something like that. But it, for me, and this is always a problem, like the, doing something like going for a walk just doesn't do it for me. Like, and I was only thinking about this earlier that I wish it did. I wish those things worked, but it always needs to be a little bit on the, you know, you asked me, would you not go running?
Like, that was the last time I asked you.
Yeah.
And we went for a wonderful walk. I thought it was a wonderful walk a few weeks ago.
Sorry, it was lovely.
Obviously, it wasn't for everybody in the audience. But anyway, it was great. I really enjoyed it.
And
most of us did, apart from you. That's the last time you're coming for a walk with us.
No, I will.
And it's really good. You should try. Maybe wait until you get older. But so while you're doing all these things, you know, you're going to do MMA, you're going to do all these mad things and play in the band, and you decided it was a good idea to actually start a new business as well, which and I'll let you talk about Prism, but Prism Online Therapy, and you can tell me why you think is important. But as I was saying to you, I just interviewed a guy that started something similar, but he, it's called Fetal. But he started as a patient. He decided that life was enough for him. And 18 months ago, he was about to go. But then he changed, you know, things changed. And he set up this Fetal.ie to provide therapy. The way he put it, needs to be accessible and affordable. So there's a whole conversation about the affordability. But you're coming from the other side, and as in, we need to provide really good therapy online, because now that's where we are. And tell me about, first of all, you just launched it, or you're about to launch it?
Yeah, we're about to launch it in 2 weeks time. Well, so it's been pretty intense going through the platform. But the idea kind of happened because the more I wrote publicly, the more, you know, articles I did, the more I actually spoke about mental health, the more I would get asked, can you recommend a good therapist? And, you know, there were a few that I knew of in, you know, in about Dublin and the wider part of the country. But inevitably, by every time I would get asked, I would, you know, pass them on, and they ended up having like 7 month waiting lists, inevitably. So I kept encountering that. But honestly, daily, at least once a day, I still get asked, can you recommend a therapist? And I get it. I absolutely, of course I get it. You want to know that you're going to invest your time, invest your money, but also invest the fact you're going to sit down and spill your guts to somebody, that you want to know that this person is good, trained, empathic, able to hold a rapport, and worth putting the time into. And I hear so many horror stories, honestly. I do. And I hear a lot of stories where people have gone to therapy and it's either meh, or it's, God, I'd never go back. It was a horrible experience.
It's a bit like that.
Oh, yeah.
That's why that picture is there, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, God. But so as I started to think about it, I thought, wouldn't it be cool if I could recommend anybody who came to me a whole bunch of therapists that were vetted, handpicked, and we're emotionally intelligent, which is never on the job spec, you know. And actually being honest, the very first time I thought about this was back when I was about 24, which is when I was on the cusp of doing clinical psychology in UCD. And I remember the panel, and I remember there's some incredible people, please don't get me wrong, some incredible people. But there were also some people who were selected onto the course that I thought, huh? I would not sit in front of them. I would never sit in front of them. Are you kidding me? No sense of ability to connect, to attune, to mirror, to listen, to hear, none of it. And yet they were selected onto this, you know, prestigious elite course. I thought, something wrong with that. And that was back when I was 24. So that always stayed with me, you know. And over the course of my own career, I've seen it, I've encountered it, I've encountered people who've been on the receiving end of it. So that was the preliminary reason I thought, wouldn't it be cool if there was an organization that housed properly vetted, exceptionally highly trained therapists who were also emotionally intelligent and who could build a rapport and who I would sit in front of. Not saying that I'm the, you know, it's, well, it's my business, so I get to choose. But like, you know, it's, I do think they're all emotionally intelligent who we've picked. They're warm. You know, if you sit into a therapy setting, you want to sit across from somebody who can theoretically hold you in your trauma or in your distress and be there for you. And everyone that we have, you know, recruited onto the platform, that's what they're like.
And is it one of the aspects as well, the breaking that taboo barrier that, you know, if I needed to go to therapy, you know, is it long? Apart from the waiting list, we could take the waiting list out for a second, but if I went to go, yeah, I would have to make an appointment and it probably put me off the idea of going somewhere. Is the online might help that?
Yeah. And, you know, I was part of a clinic in London, an online clinic, so I watched them go from beginning. I joined when they began, when they started out. So they've been going about 3 years now. So I watched their curve and I watched how they did it over there. I watched what they did well. I watched what they did wrong. And how it worked. And I also experienced, you know, clients through the platform myself and figured out what was good about it, what could be better about it. Mm. And it's wonderful, you know, and what we're going to provide as well is a chat function, you know, so, cause some people, okay, yeah, you get to be in your own house, but you maybe still don't want to be on camera. Mm-hmm. Maybe you don't even want to use your voice. So we have a chat function as well so that you can actually type, but either way, and also that makes it more affordable to say that as well. So you've got the chat option, more affordable. You have a short video option, which is again more affordable, or you have the full whack, which is a 50-minute video. But either way, you're getting access to the best quality therapists that are there, and that's a given. So it's not a whole host of faces that you don't know what they offer. You don't know how they're trained. The other aspect to it is that you get matched. So when you go onto the Prism Therapy online platform, you do an intake assessment, you put in whatever your difficulty is, and you get matched to the most appropriate therapist. You don't, that takes the burden away from the client.
That's brilliant. Well, well done. Hopefully all goes well. We probably give away a couple of free sessions here for anybody that might have to listen to our conversation. But before I ask them, the audience, if you have any question, is there anything you want to tell us that I haven't asked you? Anything at all? What's your favorite color or anything like that?
I think you want me to say yellow because you said that to me a couple of times.
against all advice, I decided to wear yellow, and I didn't know you were going to wear a fur. Otherwise, I would have worn mine. But,
you can borrow it later.
Anything else that we forgot to talk about? That because we can talk forever about, and it's a never ending conversation. I think it's important to have those conversations. But as I say, at the same time, I'm always conscious of the fact: do we talk too much about it? Do we talk too little about it? You know, and where is the balance?
Yeah. I don't know. I like that question. Do we talk too much about something, or do we talk too little about something? I think, you know, we've already touched on it, but I'm really quite hot on at the moment on how do we, and I said this at the top of this whole talk, how do we act in our own honor? I'm just so much about this at the moment because, you know, we're getting so used to this cancel culture and to pointing the finger and calling people out and look what they did wrong and, you know, making other people accountable constantly. And we avoid making ourselves accountable in the process. And by doing that, we keep ourselves down and we keep ourselves stuck, absolutely stuck in our own lives by constantly pointing and shouting at the other and blaming the other. And you know, I am on this buzz of radical accountability. How do we take accountability for ourselves? Because honestly, and I'm speaking personally here, not professionally, it is the single most thing that set me free from my own traumas. You know, from and speaking of traumas, I went through narcissistic abuse. So that's why I speak passionately about it. It's not just on a professional level. But I had to look at myself. What was going on for me? How did I allow that to happen? How why did I allow that to happen? Because I did on some level. And that doesn't, I'm not putting the blame per se on me, but it does involve looking at what processes went on there. Why did I accept that really poor behavior? Why didn't I call it when I saw it? What's happening for me there? It's not about blame. It's not about blame. I'm really clear about that. It's not about blame, but it is about how can I stand in my own honor? And I will bang that drum till the end of this talk. How can I stand in my own honor? How can I take accountability here? What can I do differently? And that's what will set us free in our own lives from anything. You know, physical abuse is a different story. It's different because you actually, you know, this is a physically dangerous situation. But anything else, the very idea of what can I do here can get you out of everything, can help you navigate any difficult dilemma that you're encountering in your life. How can I own this? What can I own here? Down to the simplest type of communication, even in a relationship. What can I own here? Nobody owes me anything in life. Nobody. If you're a full-grown adult, nobody owes you anything. Start there, because life will be so much more enjoyable.
Fantastic. I highly recommend it to listen to Louise's some of the other work she does with Niall on the therapy room and Where Is My Mind. It's really fascinating whether you're interested in psychology or not, but it's brought to you in layman's terms, if that's the best way, between you and Tony. Although Tony likes to put his words in much quicker than you. Tony tends to like to talk a little bit more, so I'm glad I gave you all the time today. But it's wonderful. It's really interesting. And all the stuff that Louise writes about in the newspapers and magazines. And so there's a huge amount. And her music is fabulous. So thanks a million for all of that. A quick round of applause would be nice. But yeah, I'm sure you have a couple of questions for Louise. If you don't, I'm going to keep asking a couple of things before they kick us out. There he goes. There's a lady at the back. Sorry, I can't really see you. Hello. How are you?
Hi,
Louise.
Hi.
I work in the space of inclusion and well-being in a pretty big corporate and a bit lucky enough to know a lot of people who are working better in the workplace around mental.
This is this is a good question. You know, I'm also curious to know if you feel or if you felt exposed to the fact that there's a lot of talk about including mental health and about, you know, kind of having a nod to doing things better.
It can just be a tick the box.
Right, yes.
It's not a one size fits all and it seems to be
yeah. Yeah, and it can be a blanket rollout of programs without any actual check-in, without any actual, what's really going on here? You know, because you've got this sort of tension of the opposites, don't you? You've got the tension of, well, I'm running the business here. You know, my main aim here is the bottom line. How do we make sure that the bottom line is rolling over on year on year? And how do I make sure my staff are happy so that I can deliver on this bottom line? And so it can be quite a binary black and white kind of exchange in any kind of corporate, but that's how it's always been historically. So what you're asking, not you, but you know, in theory, what we're asking now of corporates is no, you need to think about your people. You need to think about what's going on in the lives of your people, you know, so you're introducing a whole other skill. Actually, you're asking leaders to have a different skill, who might typically not have gravitated towards that area of life for a reason, because they don't have that skill, or they weren't exposed to it, or they didn't learn it. So it can be really intimidating, actually, for leaders to connect with the soft, what are known as the softer skills, but in actual fact are the skills that allow good business deals to go down, aren't they? You know, that the negotiations to happen properly because somebody has got empathy, somebody has an ability to tap in and attune to what the other person's coming to the table with. So they're soft skills, but they're actually central to business. So, and I do work with corporates, and a lot of it is around that. It's around how do you get leaders to understand that what we're trying to not sell them, but what we're trying to integrate into their business is actually so important for how their business is done, as opposed to, oh yeah, we're just pacifying the staff so that they'll stay. you know, and stay engaged. No. It's so much more important than that. So in answer to your question, that's my view, that it needs to be spoken about in the context of the outcomes, in the context of the bottom line, so that they can, and to help leaders understand how they can integrate it into their own lives first, so that they can then guide it and support it in their employees. I hope that makes sense.
There was a question here from the front, the gentleman at the front. And I'll come back to you in a sec.
I guess you used a phrase there which I'm intrigued by. You used the phrase fully grown adult. What does that mean? I would like to surmise that every single person in this room, to some intent and purposes, thinks through for an adult. But like, we're all. Well, I personally am a child in a man's body. how do you find a level where we feel comfy enough to present ourselves as a free world, and therefore understand the elder in front of us? Like, I get triggered every single day by a free world, and I am 14 years old, so therefore I'm a free world, and yet I don't hear or respond as
a fully grown adult.
So what does that mean? Like, how do we find a level playing field so we show up as that?
That's a good question, and thanks for your honesty as well. You know, I think we're all stretched toddlers to some degree. You know, there's no point where we suddenly cross a threshold and boom, we're made up of different composition. We're not. We're still children that have been extended and have had more experiences. And depending on the experiences that you've had over the course of your lifetime, predicts how you now engage with other people. So if you've had a whole host of experiences that were maybe challenging or negative, or there was no space for you to learn what you needed to learn from it, well, then we're going to continue repeating those same patterns over and over again. We're going to continue being triggered by the same thing over and over again. You know, again, to talk about John O'Donohue, but he talks about what's poetry, and poetry is the art of hanging around words long enough to learn what they have to teach you. And in life, it's hanging around your trauma long enough to learn what it has to teach you. You know, why are you being triggered? And I always think trigger is such an interesting word. And Gabor Mate talks about trigger. I don't know if you've heard this, but So he talks, you know, and again, publicly, we talk about triggering, like it's everyone else's fault. But what is a trigger? A trigger is the little mechanism in a big gun. You know, so why is everyone else the ammunition? And again, it involves coming back to you. You know, how, and what we spoke about at the end of that, how do we take accountability for our own reactions? That's what I mean about fully grown adult. We now have a responsibility to do that. As a child, when we have parents, when we're below, you know, that we can't stand on our own 2 feet and we can't feed ourselves and we can't work because we're not old enough and we don't have the wits about us and our brain hasn't developed yet properly, then, you know, we're still learning. We're still learning as adults. We're still learning until we die. But we are at a point where we can now own it. We can own it, and that's the difference. How do we own every time we're triggered? That's your responsibility to look at. How can I look at this? And without judgment, by the way, without judgment. This isn't about beating yourself up or blame or anything like that. It's what happened here. What happened in this interaction that made me react like that, that got my nervous system all worked up like that? When did that happen to me last? When do I remember that as a kid? Because that's what's going on. And if you can put that aside in your interactions and hold that separately, then you've learned what you need to learn about that circumstance. And then you apply that going forward. But it's kind of about ceasing and desisting from your pattern. But once you start to make it conscious, once you start to put it outside of yourself and see it as that, then you can start to dismantle it and look at it for what it is. It doesn't control you, but it is part of your experience. It has something that it is something that you've learned over time that's brought you there. But a fully grown adult just means that you get to look at it now. You get to own it and you get to choose to do something different. I hope that helps.
Great. Thanks, Amelia. There was another question in the back there.
Ah, thank you.
My question is a two-part question. Firstly, the podcast with the narcissist really resonated with me, so much so that I passed it on to a friend of mine, and as a result, I seen her on Sunday, and she's actually started counselling. She's 49 years of age, and she's got both of her kids in counselling as a result of that podcast. So thank you both of you and to Tony Bates for that. My question is, when you talked about the fact that you were in a narcissistic relationship, having studied psychology, and you know that you should have known better. I studied psychology as well, as a mature adult, and I was in a similar situation. And my question is, how did you overcome that and build your sense of self back up? I know you spoke earlier about going away to Costa Rica, and I wasn't sure whether that was the same relationship that you mentioned, and about feeling alive, but just how you kind of overcame that self-doubt. How did I get to that point?
Mm.
I should have known better. And how did you
kind of,
you know, build back the trust
for
yourself as opposed
to
after that?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. Thank you as well for sharing that.
Can I get a drink?
yeah.
Please.
You?
And two. One for Louise as well.
Okay. I spoke about the tension of the opposites there with your friend, actually. And that's something that I struggle with still, is the tension of the opposites. I'm in a band, you know, I dress like what I think looks like a rock star on stage. And then I go into a clinic, you know, and be responsible and have it all together. And I struggle with that. I struggle with the tension of those opposites. Sometimes I worry about how I'm perceived. Will I be perceived as professional on this hand if I'm doing this on the other hand? But central to that at the moment, I'm getting to your point, bear with me. But central to it all is that is who I am. I am both of those things. I also don't have it all together. I still fall. I fell this week. And when that happened, which was about 6 years, actually 6 years ago to the month, it was a need for me to be saved. I still thought I needed to be saved. And this comes back to your question, where was the radical accountability? I didn't have it. I didn't have it from my life. I wasn't being a fully grown adult. I still thought I needed to be saved. I still thought somebody else held the key to my happiness. And this person appeared in all the dynamism that they tend to and offered that net. That's literally what it was like. And it was like what you would write for Hollywood. And it just seemed to make sense. And it was that kind of elaborate craziness that made sense to me, because I don't do things by halves, you know. So this is obviously what it's going to be. I'm going to go with this, you know. And it was so whirlwindy that I didn't have time to think either. And I got caught up in it because I thought I needed to be saved. And whilst I was still a good clinician and a good therapist for the people at the time, that was my blind spot. That was my blind spot. And I tell you something. It was the significant, most destructive, but incredible turning point in my life when that went south. It has scarred me. And I think that will stay with me. I think I'll work through it and it will be better. I'll manage it better. But I know who I am now. I will never hand those keys to anybody else ever again. It doesn't mean I won't have, and I do have incredible connections now. I do, and they're real. They're real. But I will never give away that power to anyone else ever again. And that's what I learned. And in answer to your part of the question of how did I recover that sense of self, or how did I regain that sense of self? Slowly. Really slowly. Because, and I know that you know this, but it's a complete destruction of your sense of self. It's, I don't know if you've ever seen the film Mother. Have you seen that? Yeah. I don't know. I don't want to spoiler alert, because I kind of have to finish the story. But, you know, the heart that ends up in the fireplace. And it's just that, because she's given everything else away. You know, and it's not that obvious. It's, they don't talk about it being about narcissism, but it certainly was when I watched it. It's just the beating heart left in ashes in the fireplace, because she gave everything else of herself. And I was in danger of that. Sometimes I still am, because it's in my nature to give. I'm in the helping profession, for God's sake, right? So I still have it. But I have better boundaries now. So boundaries is part of your sense of self. You know, and if you feel that drifting, if you feel that losing, come back to yourself. Ask yourself what you need. Ask yourself what you need, and remind yourself that you will always survive, no matter what anybody else does. You know, and as adults, as fully grown adults, we can't be abandoned anymore. We can be left, but we can't be abandoned. We will always survive, and you will always cope. And that is how you regain your sense of self. Or at least try.
I think that's a great place to leave it. Thanks, Herminia, for being so open and honest and candid with us. And I'm just disappointed nobody asked you how you play the bass with those fingernails, but I'll ask you on our next walk. We're going for a walk tomorrow, Louise. And you're coming. So listen, thanks a million to everybody. I missed the last slide, but it's just literally to say thank you all. And thanks a million to Louise for really... oh, look at that. That's Raj. Thanks.
It's bad.
The fastest Indian in Greystones. But yeah, thanks a million. Louise, Carol, everybody.
Thank you very much.
And we didn't get a drink.
Thank you.